on Health and Human Services to order, and I'm going to open an informational meeting. Overview of senior and people with disabilities from the Department of Human Services, James and Company. Come on up. Good morning. Good
morning, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves, the Acting Assistant Director for Senior and Disability Programs in the Department of Human Services, and with me is Kathy Cooper, who's the Acting Deputy for the Senior and Disability Program in the Department. Mr. Chairman, we put together just a couple of handouts. And what we thought is we'd briefly walk you through them and then respond to questions and concerns that you have. By way of background, if I could refer you first to the handout that says Seniors and People with Disabilities Local Service Delivery Options. Since we've had a lot of questions, I thought we'd give you a quick overview of how the system is structured, and then lead into some of the other budget issues that are still looming for the program. Oregon's Senior and Disability Program was really created in 1981. Legislation was passed that year that took out of the old adult and the family services system, out of public welfare, the Senior and Disability Program. The legislation that was written in 1981, I think, remains today one of the best enabling statutes in the entire country. It really framed the principles and the values for long-term care and set in motion what ultimately, I think, created one of the better long-term care systems in the country. And through the creation of that, the founders or the movers at that time kind of ingeniously tried to link all the different elements of long-term care together. So we took the Older Americans Act, which is federal legislation, together with what the Oregon legislature created in the early 70s through Oregon Project Independence, which even preceded Medicaid, which was Oregon's initial attempt to create options for people to stay in their own homes, to receive in-home care and chore services and other assistance that would allow them to remain in their home communities and not be institutionalized. And then, of course, the Medicaid program started in full swing in Oregon in 1981. Oregon submitted the first home and community-based waiver that allowed us to draw down Medicaid funds to fund and support seniors and people with disabilities in their own homes, in their home communities, outside of nursing homes and institutional settings. And so the framework of the legislation in 1981 pulled all of those together. And uniquely, and this is remains unique in the country, the AAA system, the Area Agencies on Aging, which are created by federal statute to implement the Older Americans Act, became the vehicle in Oregon to link all of those services together. Older Americans Act, Oregon Project Independence, and then the growing Medicaid program that started in the early 80s. In the legislation, we created all kinds of flexibility for local communities to design what their own service system would look like. And I know it's confusing to a lot of people, and it looks like sort of a patchwork, but there is a whole variety of designs that local communities put together in their plans for how those services would be linked and delivered locally. And that's why we have three variations of different kinds of AAAs, or Area Agencies on Aging, and then some sub-variations of that. But very briefly, we have the three types of local service delivery vehicles are a Type A Area Agency on Aging, which just does the Older Americans Act and Oregon Project Independence. And a variety of those are in rural areas, and some of them are nonprofit agencies. Then for the Medicaid portion of the program, we said it either had to be local government or councils on governments that would handle the Medicaid part of the portfolio. So we have Type B area agencies on aging that do Older Americans Act, Oregon Project Independence, plus the Medicaid program. And then we have two variations in the Type Bs, one that do Medicaid only for seniors, and others that do Medicaid for seniors and people with disabilities. And then to perhaps further confuse the issue, we then have a couple of different variations of contract AAAs and transfer AAAs. In some cases, the AAAs, the Medicaid portion of the local AAA, is run by state employees, but they are supervised locally by counties or COGS that run the balance of the AAA program. And then we have transfer AAAs where local government does it all. There are no state employees involved. The entire portfolio is handled by local government. And so what the state and the AAAs have had to do over the years is accommodate those different local structures by backfilling whatever was needed to complement the entire integrated service system at the local level. So if there's just a Type A agency, for example, that does Older Americans Act, then either the state, typically the state would have to have local offices of state employees that would handle the Medicaid program. Or if you had a Type B area agency on aging that just did the Medicaid portion for seniors, then we would have to create a state office that would do the Medicaid portion for people with disabilities. So that's why you see a variety of different structures across the state, and why it sometimes appears confusing, although locally it's made sense to people because that's the way they've articulated the plan at the local level.
Yeah, but James, I guess, and it is confusing to me, just the rationale of you know, like that you have a Type A, you still got to have somebody administering the other programs that aren't included because it's a Type A, and I guess I'm wondering how much sense in this day and age to have these potential disconnects and silos actually makes sense.
Mr. Chairman, I think at the local level it works much better than many of us think it would, given the structure, simply because that's the way the local plans and those networks have developed. The big stumbling block, it's been, I think, the position of the state, it's been the position of O4AD and many of the advocates, that we should link this all together in a single kind of model. But the stumbling block and the barrier has been the equity issue. And that is where the state originally turned the program over, particularly the Medicaid program, turned the program over to local government or councils on government. We at that time gave them the entire portfolio, the state employees, the services and supplies, the entire budget for managing that program was transferred, and under state statutes, state employees were transferred to be county or local government or COG employees. But once that was set in motion, in the subsequent years, the way the state budgeting processes work, we've simply given cost of living increases or CPI increases like we do to all subcontractors. But in most cases, their costs as local government have risen just like costs in state government have risen. So they have fallen farther and farther behind on what it would have cost had the state operated the program. And hence the major debate that's occurred now for multiple legislative sessions on equity. And I think the AAAs and the advocates would tell you if we resolve the equity issue, you'd see a fairly quick movement towards doing Type B two agencies statewide, where you've really linked all of the elements of, again, Older Americans Act, Medicaid, and OPI together for all the populations. And we have begun new discussions again with the AAAs just recently, saying what would it take to get us there? What's a multi-year plan in which we could resolve some of these equity issues and begin to consolidate the structures at the local level? But again, the statute is built with lots of choice, lots of local options, and we think we'd have to move in concert with our local partners in that kind of planning effort and have to resolve the equity issues.
Okay, well, with your list, the only county of significant population, that's in the Type A would be Deschutes, and they are probably in there from before they were a county of significant population, I would assume. So that may be a factor in this. Where does Medicare fit in here? Is that a whole separate thing somewhere else? Because this is, for a large part, you have a significant Medicare population here.
Correct. And Medicare is not directly part of our budget, although in some cases we pay the premiums for Medicare. But Medicare is, and the Medicare payments to nursing homes and all that is outside of our direct budget.
I guess that, and I understand that it's separate funding, but it's another disconnect in a service package. I guess my problem is I'm trying to find ways to make sure that one hand knows what the other's doing, and we'll get some testimony later on at the local level to see if indeed this is working well, but. I mean, Medicaid certainly is something that I'm keenly interested in at the moment. But could you go in a little bit more? Are you going to talk specifically about the Medicaid dollars here and at some point, or am I jumping ahead?
Yeah, no, we were going to talk about structure and then talk a little bit more about. About the budget, and then we've sort of summarized that you request all the budget reductions through all the special sessions leading up to House Bill 5100.
Okay. Got questions?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yeah, just to follow up, because I tend to think that there'd be far more efficiency if these services were together. And it looks like the bigger counties or the populous counties have done that. I would think it would be even, is it a turf issue? Are there reasons why the smaller counties haven't wanted to combine?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I don't think it's so much turf issues. It's just local planning that's evolved over many, many years. And for the small counties, since, again, we require the Medicaid portion of the budget has to go through government, it would have really required a much bigger base than a small rural county could put together. And in those counties, in many of the bigger counties, in fact, the counties have put together multi-county councils on government to operate the program. So even in the Mid-Valley and in some of the metropolitan areas, you have cross-county AAAs that have formed to create a bigger Medicaid base. And it would require small counties to band together, either in a council of governments or a type of variation like that. And we've never pressured them to do that. And, of course, the issue of equity would then loom up, that we would have to make sure, we would have to guarantee that if we were transferring the state portion of the Medicaid program to them, that we would somehow assure that they would continue to be compensated at the same rate and not start falling behind. And we've never provided that assurance. And I think that's been the real stumbling block. And like I said, I think if we figured out how to cross that bridge successfully, I think you'd see, I don't know if rapid movement, but certainly everyone would come to the table and be much more interested in consolidating and setting up a uniform network in each part of the state. It's also in rural areas. I mean, there's major concern that in rural areas they simply not get swallowed up by big multi-county agencies, and we understand that. And so the Type A's are very interested, but they're struggling now. The Type A's are really struggling with the cuts in Oregon Project Independence, and if that program doesn't even survive, whether just a single rural Type A AAA can survive just on Older American Act funding, we doubt it. So I think we're coming to that point soon with a budget where some of the smaller area agencies on aging may not be able to survive, and we'll have to almost force that issue at that point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, to talk a little bit about the Medicaid program, Medicaid, again, was started in 1981, where Oregon submitted the first home and community-based waiver that allowed us to use funds that historically had been used in institutional settings or nursing homes in community-based care. Congress had no sooner finished passing the legislation that allowed waivers against institutional services, and Oregon had the very first application in before the regulations had even been printed. And we've maintained a Medicaid waiver since that time, and it's grown substantially through the 80s and through the 90s, to the point where we can cover a wide variety of services in community settings, either in a person's own home, with their relatives, in an assisted living facility, in a foster care home, at a residential care facility, a whole variety of options that are all funded under the Medicaid program in lieu of institutional care or nursing home services. That program has the eligibility for that program over the years has evolved around what's now known as the service eligibility rules, or the survival priorities 1 through 17 that you're all very familiar with 1 being the highest impairment level and 17 being the lowest impairment level. Oregon has been fairly generous and at the levels 15 through 17 in letting in people that don't have substantial impairment needs but still need assistance to stay in their own homes, and that's all been covered under the Medicaid program. And when folks were covered under the Medicaid program, they also then became eligible for health coverage. And so through the years, they've been made eligible through OHP, the different variations of the Oregon Health Plan as well. Plus, in our local offices, we attempted to integrate all services. So food stamps, for example, is eligibility for food stamps is done also in our area agencies on aging, so that a senior or a person with disability coming in can be linked to any benefit that might be available through the state or the federal government. The Medicaid waivers, as I indicated, have expanded significantly over the years, and the level systems that were instituted were designed over the years to make people eligible and to help and assist in planning for services. They were never designed, and we've made this comment here in recent weeks over all the anguish over the budget reductions. The level system was never designed to terminate thousands of people from service. It's not what it was designed to do. And yet that has now become the primary vehicle or the instrument in making significant budget reductions. And that's why you see so much concern about the levels. And historically, people that were in our Medicaid program, if they were level 17 or below on the impairment scale, usually they didn't even know what level they were assessed at. It was immaterial to them because they were in the door, they were eligible for Medicaid, and they then had choice across the Medicaid services that were available. It's only now that exactly what level you're assessed at has become, in many cases, you know, a life or death or a significant quality of life decision. And that's what's created so much consternation across our entire field with our field staff and our area agencies on aging and for our seniors as well. We are in almost nonstop negotiations with the federal government on restructuring the Medicaid program and paring it down. Since our Medicaid waivers include all the levels and the people that historically have been accessed into the system, we now have to go and we have to amend all those federal waivers, and we have to reproject who's eligible and what those reduced costs will be. And the federal government has to approve that. They have not granted approval at this point in the level cuts 10 through 17. So we're moving on the one hand in giving notices and taking actions to terminate people from service at the same time that we're negotiating with the federal government those changes in the waiver. One of the primary concerns, and I think we mentioned it when we were here a month ago and giving an overview of some of the budget reductions, one of the primary concerns that the federal government has is around health and safety. and saying that once you take people into Medicaid, once you make that choice and you start providing services and support, you can't simply dump them out of Medicaid. You have to do some kind of reasonable transition process assuring their health and safety. And we are now, particularly for levels 10 through 14, looking at a transition package that still is very modest that would allow some cash assistance and some assistance from our case managers that will go on after their termination from the Medicaid program. And the federal government will still allow us to match federal funds for a very short period of time, 2 to 3 months, after the person has actually exited the Medicaid program. The bigger dilemma in the Medicaid program for next biennium is, I think, in special session 3, one of the reductions that we proposed was to cap the waiver. And this is particularly important for 03-05. Once levels 10 through 17 are cut and what we're left with is levels 1 through 9 for 03-05, we have virtually no growth in new eligibles for the 03-05 biennium. I think on top of natural turnover, and typically we've said about 28% of individuals in the waiver program transition, I think, on a biennial basis, so we have capacity to backfill waiver slots for people that have left services or died or whatever. So we have limited capacity there. But on top of that, I think statewide, we in the caseload projections for next biennium, we can add 4 people per month statewide. So the program is virtually capped for 03-05 as well, and we've never had a capped program. So quite independent of the reductions of existing people, we, for the first time, together with our local partners, have to figure out how we're going to triage on a very, very limited access basis new people coming into waiver services who may otherwise still be eligible for nursing home services, but they will be on a waiting list for home and community-based services. And we're going to have to watch that very carefully because the nursing home caseload could quickly start to grow very rapidly again and the vacancies in nursing homes start to fill up, in which case there's a big cost shift and our costs start going up on the institutional side. So those are the dilemmas we face now, both in reducing the Medicaid program and then sharply curtailing any growth for 03-05 and perhaps even to biennia after that. So it is a fundamental change in how we've done the Medicaid program for senior and disability programs for the last 20 years.
James, what percent of Medicaid assistance clients are Medicare eligible?
Do we know? About 40%.
About 40%. I would have thought the number would have been higher.
Yeah.
Why is that number so low?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we serve a lot of people with disabilities that wouldn't be Medicare eligible. That
okay, so but those who are the appropriate age are in both.
Correct.
Okay. And those with disabilities, what percent are SSI? I like to ask questions. I'm trying to get a feel for how much wraparound we have for the various portions of this client base. You know, so how many of the disability folks are SSI eligible?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the exact number. We can get it for you today.
Ballpark,
it's a 2-year qualification period to get there.
So, I mean, could one assume that they've either been SSI or up till now general assistance, or as well as Medicaid, or...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, we can break those runs out for you. The many people with disabilities are SSDI eligible as opposed to SSI. So if you have a person with a disability and their parents are retired, for example, chances are that they will have they'll be on SSDI instead of SSI. And this, in fact, was a very important factor because in one of the budget scenarios that we were looking at, we, I think last November or December, one of the variations we explored was taking the entire system to 100% of SSI standard, simply because that was a very objective income standard that the federal government would have to approve, and we were very concerned that the federal government might not approve the waiver changes in the level cuts, and still remain somewhat concerned about that. But going to an objective income standard of 100% of SSI across the entire system was simply devastating. It took out nearly two-thirds of the senior population. And worse, in the disability population, if you're SSDI eligible, you're almost automatically above the SSI standard. And so by the nature of the disability population and most being on SSDI if their parents are retired, you just wiped out whole-scale large parts of the disability population, and it rippled into mental health, developmental disabilities, and other areas. And that's why we quickly backed off that as an income standard for using that threshold as...
Mr. Chair, could we have an explanation of SSI and the difference with SSDI?
Mr. Chairman, sure. You want to do that?
Thank you, Mr. Tapes.
You know, you could have left the room and you didn't mistake all this.
For the record, I'm Julia Huddleston, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Rate Setting and the Senior and People with Disabilities Budget. Supplemental Security Income.
Pardon?
Supplemental Security Income, SSI, is payable to seniors. It's currently paid in the amount of roughly $547 a month. I'm probably off a dollar. Our waiver standard currently is an income of no more than 300% of supplemental security income. So a person can have 300% of that 547, or roughly $1,650 a month, and still qualify for waivered services. SSDI is supplemental security income for disabled individuals. That income standard is slightly higher, I believe, by about $200 a month. Again, I will double-check on that amount and get you the information.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, the other reason the income standards become important and why there's been so much confusion about eligibility as we're making these reductions is for levels 10 through 17, again, historically, the income standard for long-term care is 300% of SSI. When those people have been eligible for long-term care, they've also been eligible for Medicaid under the health plan. When we take them out of long-term care, which is up to the 300% of SSI standard based on the level cuts, then we have to go back to what their income is for purposes of eligibility for health care. And so depending then whether you're 100% of SSI or 135% of the federal poverty level, and there's a whole series of percentages there, and the levels 10 through 17 losing long-term care can actually end up in three or four different categories of health benefits, depending on whether they're Medicare or not Medicare eligible, or whether they fall into the standard or the OHP plus category. So when we've sent the one notice for termination of long-term care services, they may then get one of four notices for changes in their health plan eligibility, and that's why we've seen such a tremendous amount of confusion about eligibility, because we have multiple eligibility scenarios that are occurring at the same time. So both for our consumers and our case managers, that's what they've had to go through in this short period of time.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you. James, would people be disqualified if they owned their own homes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. Under Medicaid, you can continue to own your own home, car, and I think up to $2,000 of other assets. So, no, you don't have to lose your home to still be eligible for Medicaid.
Okay, so even somebody on SSID, that would not be disqualifying? Okay, thank you.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, we were asked just to summarize again all the budget reductions that proceeded through all the special sessions leading up to 5100, and we've put that all together on one short list, and I don't know if you'd like us to walk through that or simply respond to questions on it. But this is the cumulative list across all the client reductions, the level cuts, the provider reductions, the termination of cost of living adjustments, and a variety of other reductions that have occurred since the beginning of the special sessions.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Representative Tomac.
Thank you. James, again, when it lists general fund and then total fund, I assume that is we're losing federal funds that much in federal funds. Is that correct? Thank you.
Correct.
I mean, we've kind of been through these before. I just if you kind of wanted to do a general walkthrough, I think I really don't need to get into real detail unless the committee would want.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The numbers that are in bold here, well, really all of the numbers, how many of those will be reversed with the backfill on House Bill 5075? Do we have any idea of what of those temporarily will be covered?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it's levels 10 through 14, I believe, that were covered. What part? And the medically needy program that was restored. I don't think any of the rate reductions were restored in the bill, so it would be primarily those two areas. And the medically needy here is simply the staffing portion of it. The budget for medically needy is in the OMAP budget. The other thing I should point out, Mr. Chairman, is these are the reduction scenarios and the targets, but we've been fairly explicit here that we're falling short in a couple of areas and have some unresolved issues in even meeting the existing targets in both the first round of cuts of level 15 through 17. We've done reassessments for virtually all of those individuals of the 4,100 notices that were sent. We actually discontinued services to 3,200, 31 individuals. A variety of the others are, some are in various stages of hearing appeals, and others shifted then in reassessments down to levels 10 through 14. We have just sent out, I think, 6,300 notices for levels 10 through 14, and again, we expect that phenomena will repeat itself, that we're doing mass reassessments and a portion of that population could shift into higher impairment levels, in which case they would still be covered. So as we identify less people than originally budgeted that will be actually terminated from services, we're going to have to find other areas to make up the budget difference. And we are already preparing for an April rebalance of the department, some major holes in those reduction targets. We also have significant, almost $10+ million in rate reductions that I'm sure you've heard of, to nursing homes, to assisted living facilities, foster care, residential care facilities. And those have not taken effect. They were scheduled for February 1st. They require legislative approval. And I think we're falling short by about $80,000 a day in general fund, falling away from our target every day commencing February 1st if those reductions are not made. So there's growing holes in these numbers here that we're going to have to find other sources to make up the difference. In addition, on Mr. Chairman, on the developmental disability side, of course, the $12 million reduction from 5,100 still has not been taken. We're still negotiating with the lawyers around the Staley agreement. And the further we postpone making reductions there, that adds to our budget dilemmas at the present time.
What happens if the feds come back and say that under the waiver you cannot discontinue services for 10 to 17? What happens at that point? I mean, yeah. I mean, you're going ahead with the assumption that they're going to grant you the ability to do that, but they haven't specifically done that yet, have they?
Means you got to start smoking more, Mr. Chair.
Oh. I'm doing the best I can on that, but you know, they won't let me smoke inside the building, so I'm kind of limited.
Mr. Chairman, We have been in constant contact with the federal government, so we're not springing any surprises on them.
I understand that, but you haven't got a decision yet.
We don't have a decision. What we've discussed in detail with them is what steps we will take for transition to ease both the pain and to find other alternatives, if other alternatives exist. And we're seeking their, and they've actually worked with us on how that will be structured, plus agreed that they will continue federal match for a portion of that even after waiver services are terminated. So we have point blank asked them, does that mean by your work with us on transition planning that in effect you're saying you will approve? And their response very carefully has been, no, that doesn't assume automatic approval, but it's a good step in that direction. Levels 15 through 17, I don't think the federal government will dispute. In fact, in previous reviews of our Medicaid program, they themselves felt that 15 through 17 was right on the cusp in terms of people that would truly be Medicaid eligible, that we had perhaps been a little bit expansive there. So I don't think levels 15 through 17 will. 10 through 14, our biggest concern is level 10. In level 10, you get to the real substantial assistance level. You have people in chairs with significant mobility needs, incontinent. I mean, you're talking about significant levels of care. And if anything is going to be a reach for our federal partners, I think it will be level 10.
Okay. Chair?
Representative West. Well, let me just continue this thought. I guess two things concern me here. Number one is if there is refusal on some of the levels that you're discontinuing, that we are setting ourselves up for legal action once that determination is made, and which is a potential. But the other, what really concerns me the most is, I'm assuming a significant portion of level 10 through 14 folks could transition into nursing homes, and then it's going to cost us significantly more than it's costing us to do this program.
Mr. Chairman, levels 10 through 14 that are terminated in our Medicaid waiver also are blocked from access to nursing home care. So on the state plan amendment, those levels of care, the eligibility, they go across to the nursing home side. So that applies in both institutional and home and community settings. Because otherwise, you're absolutely right, our nursing home caseloads would just start to skyrocket. The big concern we've had is, and this question has been posed many times, both internally and externally, well, if they simply won't approve the waiver, what can the state do? Well, the state can terminate the waiver. You can simply terminate the waiver. And we've been asked that question, well, what happens if you terminate the waiver? Because the feds can't tell you that you can't do that. It's an optional state program. But to have any Medicaid in the state at all, you still have a core requirement to provide basic nursing and rehab services. And so at some threshold, whether it's level 10 or above that, the state cannot block people from coming into nursing homes or institutional care. And if you terminated the waiver, you simply would have your caseloads on the institutional side that would skyrocket. And we've done some initial budget projections that said if we did that, if we terminated the waiver now, probably even in 2003-2005, any illusionary savings from terminating the waiver would be quickly eclipsed in 2003-2005 by a skyrocketing caseload on the institutional side. So terminating the waiver just really isn't an option that works economically, as well as the obvious reason of what people want in terms of home and community-based care. So it would be both a bad policy decision, both programmatically and economically from our perspective. So we really are kind of bound up and the other dilemma, sort of the hydraulics of this, because we've been roundly criticized for taking such deep reductions on the rate side to nursing homes and ELFs and RCFs, and it's correct. I mean, we have the rate reductions roll back almost to 99.01 levels, and I'm sure the industry is very correctly pointing out that that's going to have a huge effect. Facilities will close and consolidate, and you're going to have a major dislocation in private pay and other parts of the service industry as well because of these reductions. But the hydraulics, if you go down to level 10 and you say we're really stretching it at level 10, we can't go deeper into the client cuts, I mean, that's the only other place that we have left to go. You either make reductions in payments to providers or you eliminate people from service. And we've kind of drawn a line in the sand at level 10 and said that's a stretch to get there. We can't go deeper. We don't think the federal government would ever approve. And that's why the hydraulics have pushed out the reductions on the rate side.
Representative Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James, how much specificity is there when evaluating the patients in their various levels? I mean, say between 11 and 12. I mean, the department sent out, and I thought it was, I appreciated it very much. This is what a 1 is, this is what a 2 is, 3, 7, 17. But what I couldn't tell in that written classification was the acuity in the evaluation of the patient. It looked like a lot of subjective stuff. It looked pretty tough between, you start getting down the lower ones, fine, I understand that. But in the areas we're talking about, 10 through 17, and it just seemed that there could be a wide discrepancy. You and I might evaluate someone at a 13. Someone else might evaluate them at a 15. Someone else might evaluate them at an 11. How is this done? And more importantly, how well is this done?
Mr. Chairman, let me let Kathy Cooper is... been doing a lot of the field work and training and setting up these systems.
For the record, my name is Kathy Cooper. I'm the acting deputy assistant director for the Department of Human Services, services to seniors and people with disabilities. Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, I think the best way to respond to your question is that the staff that do the work in our field offices are trained case managers. They are staff that have an understanding of both the client's physical needs. They have a little bit of understanding of medical information about clients. And we have spent the last 2 years developing an electronic tool that assists our case managers through a very detailed assessment of clients' needs that helps them evaluate both physical needs, emotional needs, and some of their other needs around activities of daily living. They do some activities around time to get up and go to see the person's mobility. They do things around mini mental status exams to help understand if the person has an understanding of relation of time and space. And so our staff are trained, and this tool helps them and accompanies them through a series of questions and assessments to be able to do the best job we can. Each client is really a human being, and each one of these assessments is based on that person, and it's based on that person at that time. And so we do other things. We not only do interviews with the client, we spend time with their caregiver, with family members and other informal supports. We look at medical records. We talk with their physicians so that we have the best assessment of this client across many days, weeks, and months, not just based on their best day when we're in their home doing this assessment. The other thing we have done over the last 6 or 8 months is spent time with our staff and our program managers to try to redefine and clarify our service priority rule and to clarify the words assistance, substantial assistance, so that when our staff are trying to make that evaluation, does this person need assistance with mobility and eating, or does this person need substantial substantial assistance. We have helped them through much clearer definition and rule about what assistance and substantial assistance means.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westland, the other thing we've done, because there was some growing criticism that case managers in the field would simply reassess everyone to make them eligible, and we have actually tracked by each local office, either in the AAAs or in offices managed by state employees, the percentage shift from different levels to see if we have trends there that indicate whole-scale evaluations are making people eligible. And I think we have found consistently that that's not occurring, that there is a ratio of change. But we expected that because many of the assessments could have been old. And again, historically, these assessments were never used to triage people out of service. So this is a very different environment we're in. I think every case manager, well, in fact, all of us instinctually want to do everything we can to make that person eligible. So we're often working against our own judgment and instincts in what we think this person needs. But I think our case managers, even though that's been a pretty torturous exercise for them, to say the least, pretty consistently across the state, we have not found sort of mass movements of people into higher impairment levels.
Mr. Chair.
Can I follow up?
Yeah, okay, yeah, follow up.
Okay, you told me what you did. Now tell me how well you do it. That was the second half of the first question.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, our staff do these evaluations on a continuing basis. Every month they do a whole number of reassessments. In the last year, we have put in place a field review process where we have gone out and reviewed the assessments that our staff have done. We are doing constant reviews right now through this electronic system to make sure that the staff are doing the proper assessment and evaluation of clients. As people have been removed from services and they have been doing requests for appeals, each and every appeal that has come to our central office has been re-reviewed by our program technical staff to make sure that we have done the best and the most accurate assessment and that we really have done the best in terms of this client before we've moved that on to the hearings process. So again, we've done another level of reconsideration of that assessment.
How often are you wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, I would say that is a minor number. In all the evaluations and reviews we've done over the last many months of these very, very difficult cuts, we have found very few that we really have had to call the offices and say, we think you've missed some critical information. We think you've missed a piece of this evaluation. We say, for the most part, our staff have done a very, very good job of these evaluations.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not sitting here being mad at you. I'm sitting here bleeding right along with you. I mean, I'm not enjoying any of this. Part of my concern is I didn't see anything in the levels, or if I did, I just missed it, about dementia. I mean, you had physical capabilities in there, and that, you know, looked pretty stratified. You know, I could be very ambulatory and very capable of dressing myself and walk right out the front door, you know, into the path of the truck or off into the forest. Mm. How does that work into your evaluation in terms of need of care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, that's a very good question. One of the most difficult parts of our job is around the area of cognition, and it is trying to determine dementia, Alzheimer's, and for people with traumatic brain injuries. And we did some special training with our staff during the month of December and January, really focusing on the cognitive issues that face many of our clients. It is absolutely true that you can meet a person with dementia or Alzheimer's on one day and they're as lucid and as clear and can have the best understanding of relation of time and space and adaptation to their local environment, and the next day have really be decompensated and not able to do that. So our staff have been doing some of these mini mental exams. We have worked with them on looking at, we look at 8 different areas of cognitive health to do that evaluation. And many of the clients that we see that have moved out of these levels 15 through 17 are exactly clients that have cognitive issues, and they have moved to level 3 in our scale, which is an area we haven't talked about because we're not cutting those areas. And those are people with traumatic brain injury or dementia, Alzheimer's.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, when field staff and local AAA staff and others have brought to us cases that they feel for that precise reason should fit into the eligible category as opposed to those people being excluded, we've done a series of individual case reviews. We've actually brought those cases to the central office, sat down with field staff, and gone through them. And I think in most cases there was particular concern around head-injured folks, for example, that, again, might have all of their activities of daily living. So we've also been very open that we need to do major revisions to the service priority rules. That is a long-term goal to revamp those rules, particularly now that they're being used in such a different way from the way they were originally intended. And the cognition factors have to be a big factor in that, because eventually we want similar scales to be used on the developmental disabilities side, and there that issue really hits home. You have people with moderate to mild retardation that could have all of their adult daily living skills, but need constant supervision, or exactly what you said, they'd walk outside and be harmed, or harm would come to them. So it is an issue that we're sensitive to.
And maybe it's because a methodology that was designed to be a diagnostic tool is now being used as a budget reduction tool. I'm uncomfortable with this whole thing for some reason. I can't put my finger on it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westwell, we are very uncomfortable with it. But in every alternative we looked, given the moment right now and the reduction targets, because the clear, objective, unquestionable standard would have been income. And the only income standard we could have gone to would have been 100% of SSI, because anything above that, under federal law, a person can buy their way into Medicaid through an income cap trust, which is a whole another discussion. But effectively, virtually everyone could have made themselves eligible for continuing Medicaid services unless we went to an absolute 100% of SSI across the board. Well, that would have left us, I mean, that's $554 a month. You could have a woman with severe Alzheimer's and all kinds of other conditions getting $700 a month in income and be completely ineligible for long-term care in Oregon and not able with that meager income to purchase anything close to what she might have needed. So that drove us back into the level cuts. And so I think we share your concern. It's a bit of an imprecise tool to do what we're using it for now, but we really didn't think we had other choices at this point in time.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Tomei.
Well, thanks. Asked the question was several questions ago, following up on Representative Westland's question. I'm assuming that there are more objective criteria than we're aware of. Is that true in defining the levels? Because I'm referring back to Representative Westland's, the list that we've gotten, which is very imprecise. I'm assuming that there are more precise criteria that we're just not aware of. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, that is true. As I described, we do have an electronic tool that we spent over 2 years developing, which is a detailed assessment of all of the activities of daily living at all these different levels of assistance, full assistance, substantial assistance. And actually, that tool was developed at the recommendation and request of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and it was one of the conditions conditions of the renewal of our home and community-based waiver. And so they were active participants at the table with us in the development of that sophisticated tool. Our interviews and assessments with clients most often take us 2, 3, 4 hours. They are not something simply looking at a piece of paper and saying, it appears to me you need substantial assistance with mobility. It's activities like asking the client in their home, could you go get your medication for me so we can observe the person's ability to move around their home? Talking to them about preparation of meals, you know, asking them what kinds of things they have available in their home, getting them to move and show us how they perform their activities of daily living. So we are doing a much more detailed assessment than anything that would appear on a one-page piece of paper.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, it occurred to me as we were moving towards the cutting back of levels, the upper levels, 15 through 17, that at that point, folks were being reassessed to see if maybe their circumstances had changed and that they would be needed to be reclassified at lower, or I should say higher priority levels. Do you have a sense of how many people have been reclassified to these lower levels, to the higher priority levels?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, yes, actually we started with approximately 4,100 clients that received notices from the department in levels 15 through 17. We ended up only removing 3,200 clients. And so those other clients were reassessed to higher levels. And again, as we said, we have reviewed on an ongoing basis those different clients to see what those assessments were. We feel those assessments were done properly.
Thank you.
So it's 15 through 17.
15 through 17.
Representative Anderson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. I think you answered in the testimony here just a minute ago, but between levels 1 and 17, are there different payments in different categories or on different levels? In other words, does level 1 have a larger payment than level 17?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, no. The levels have functioned in the past simply as a door to get a person in the system. The living setting that the person chooses determine the level of payments that are made by Medicaid long-term care. So, for example, a person at a level 9 might choose to go to a nursing facility, in which case the state would likely pay about $111 a day. They might also choose to go to an assisted living facility, okay. And our average payment there is about $1,600 a month. If they stayed at home, they'd have a home care worker in at $8.56 an hour.
Yeah, right. The kind of care that they're receiving, and if we keep people in their own homes, it's going to cost us a quarter of what it does.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the complicating factor is payment isn't triggered purely on the complexity of need for the person themselves. It depends what other supports they have available. And I think the magic of sort of a community-based system is you try to fill in around the margins if the person has family, if they have neighbors, if they're connected to their community and they have other natural supports, then we can provide a limited number of in-home care hours or chore services or someone to help buy their groceries or do the banking or a variety of things like that because they have other supports that helps meet their other care needs. Whereas someone who has no family member, no other connection, et cetera, who can't or doesn't own their own home and have the income to be in their own apartment or something like that may need to go into a care setting. So you can't ballpark levels exactly with costs. Having said that, I think if you look at nursing homes, though, overall you'll have people with much higher impairment levels. You'll see a few outliers there. So there is a correlation of cost and level of care, but not across the board, and there's so many variations to that.
Can I follow up, please?
Yes.
Second question was, can you give me a basic ballpark of how many clients per caseworker generally in the AAAs or the state, or is there a difference between?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we have an allocations process that we have developed with our AAA organization. In our case management levels, it is based on setting, and so it gets pretty complicated. For a person in a home in a community-based setting, it's 1 to 69 clients, one case manager to 69 clients. It goes up over 100 when we're talking about clients in nursing facilities. And so by setting, there are different averages, but overall it's somewhere in the neighborhood across our services for our case managers, about a 1 to 90.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another follow-up, please.
Yes.
How often do you do your reevaluations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, our evaluations are required to be completed yearly, except in some of our special programs where they're required to be done every 6 months.
And a final follow-up. Would it be possible to, I assume you have good trust in the nursing homes and most of the foster care, they are certified. Is it possible to depend on their knowledge of the patients in spreading those reevaluations out and saving money in that area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, actually, we do rely on the caregiver and provider information. We have a requirement under Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to be able to do an evaluation of the person's financial eligibility and service eligibility yearly, and they want that to be independent from the provider's assessment to make sure that we're providing and paying for what really should be used in terms of using federal dollars. So they do expect an independent evaluation from a case manager or from an eligibility worker. When we are working with clients in settings such as nursing facilities, we really do rely tremendously on that record that has been developed on a daily basis by that nursing facility. So we do use that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say in your explanation about the evaluations and everything, I really appreciate the work that you're doing there. And I know I have family members. My mother's passed the century mark last year and is in nursing care, but I have a mother-in-law who's in foster care. And I've seen a rapid decline in her, which would, if although she's not in these programs, would be reevaluated and be ratcheted up in a normal process of life, and not that your agency is trying to manipulate the numbers to move people up. I think that's just a natural progression. I appreciate that. I mean, that's a lot of people you're evaluating, a lot of work.
Thank you.
Are we done for the moment? Okay. Every now and then we break out and do a question thing, and it's very good.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, there's lots of other issues we could touch on, but I know you have other witnesses, so we'll be happy to come back or answer follow-up questions.
Representative Wallace Henderson, you okay?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll reiterate, a client can, I'll go back. I think it's extremely difficult to categorize some of these people, especially when they're on the cusp. One client can be very lucid one day and be able to do, and then the next day regress or get better even, and then a week later they can go back and forth. So it isn't like, you know, a person's on a continuum in one direction. We can't get upset on an evaluation if it's wrong one time, because that's why I'm amazed when you say you're evaluating. If you have over 100 clients, mm-hmm. there's only 260 work days in a year, and some of that's vacation and holidays. So I'm wondering, they're having to reevaluate if you have over 100 caseloads at least. Mm-hmm. No, that's different, though. Anyway, it's very, very complicated, so I want the public to make sure that they realize, as well as the committee, that we can't be too hard on the case managers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you'll hear from some of the other folks the workload and the stress on everybody in our local AAAs and state offices has just been extraordinary. That doesn't compare to the pain of people that are losing services. So, you know, our pain is kind of immaterial in this, but they've had just an extraordinary workload here in a very short period of time with thousands of people that are very upset and facing pretty chaotic circumstances in their lives. So, I mean, I don't think we could agree more with your concern and statement.
And James, we see schematics of silos and how the authorities flow from top to bottom and stuff like that. Do you guys have anything? I mean, you know, part of it is the fact that we probably chose the wrong decade to reinvent things, but we went ahead and did it anyway. Do you have anything like that? That I saw this for the Department of Ed that actually had the people. You know, like rather than say, you know, you got the director of programs like that, but actually had FTE tied to that. Do you have something like that, or would LFO have something like that?
Mr. Chairman, you mean the organization chart for SPD?
With the FTE.
We absolutely.
All positions, sort of. I would like to see something
okay,
like that.
Okay, we can.
Going to kind of help us get a sense of things.
We can send that. We can send that right over.
Okay.
Thank you. Walk down the hall.
Well, I just thought of it, okay?
It's a good thought for you.
Okay. It's not a bad thought for me. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, maybe I could add, just as you look at that organization chart for the department and for seniors and people with disabilities, the piece that it will not be obvious is all of the direct funding we give to the AAAs for our transfer programs that staff many of these case management and eligibility positions. So that might be another important piece that we could send over to you if you'd like to see it.
Yes, thank you.
Correct, Mr. Chairman, because in positions you'll see the state employees in AAA contract offices and state offices, but okay.
We're trying to get right. What I want is the full picture of.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Thank you. Thank you. And I like to share, too. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. What do I do? You know, I saw you went over there to eat your banana because you didn't bring enough for everybody. Understand that. Jacqueline. Good morning.
Whoops. Staying with my new brain here.
If I serve in the legislature for a whole decade, I'll have enough paper to build a house.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, committee administrator. My name is Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones. I am the director of the Oregon Association of the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, O4AD. That is that complex system you've been hearing about where service delivery is done through Type A's, Type B's, B1's, B2's, contracts, and transfers. There is, in fact, in the handout that James Taves gave you a breakdown on what that looks like. So I will refer to that at some point. I brought with me this morning John DeGroote. He is our director down in the Roseburg area, and I'll let him introduce himself, and also he'll be here to sort of backfill with some questions or some answers to some of your questions. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I know that you all received this particular piece right here, The Oregon Way, Independence, Dignity, and Choice, before the session began, and I believe everyone's received it once since then, and so then today this is your third time, so this is the charm. And what it does is sort of helps give a broad overview of our system as it is, and I think if you read the article in The Oregonian yesterday, Erin Hoover Barnett wrote an article about our system, and she interviewed someone from New York who said something to the effect of, fancy that, New York for years has been trying to make its system look like Oregon's, and now you're trying to make your system look like ours. And in New York, in fact, all of their nursing homes are full. They have people waiting to get in their nursing homes. People that live in nursing homes in New York can still drive. Whereas people that live in our nursing homes here, the same number that we've had for about the last 20 years, our average has remained the same, don't drive. If you drive, you're probably not going to make it into one of the facilities. So with that, I'll just walk through some of the handouts I have in here, and I'll respond to some of the things I heard a little bit earlier, and then I'll stand for questions and also share this time with John. So besides this document, and on the back, by the way, are the names of the various area agencies on aging, where they're located, and a phone number for you. I know that I understand that most of you are going on the DHS payroll as case managers, since you're now responding to the prescription drug issues and the medically needy, so you'll want to go to these particular offices to pick up your checks. I'm actually just kidding. I'm sure you know that.
Darn.
Actually, you'll get the same rate that the AAAs that have the equity issue get. So you'll get 85 cents on the dollar for your work.
More than we get today.
That's probably true. At any rate, what we've done, I think one of the original hand are the top, if they're in the same order that I think they are, this top piece right here, it's just sort of one of our recent sort of what we call shriek pieces. This is what we're sort of frustrated about right now, and we have just watermarked it with the 8,000 more cuts at levels 10 through 14, and we did that because the House restored levels 10 through 14 in their budget lethal cuts package, and the Senate has not done that to this point. So we also did that because we were misinformed. We thought that the number of people in levels 10 through 14 was 5,000, 6,000. As it turns out, it's over 8,000. And a little bit of that has to do with your question earlier about how we classify people and how often we get to them to reassess. And if anything, when we get to them to reassess, actually what we're trying to do is just stabilize this population. This is not a population that you're going to serve. They're going to get well, pull themselves up by their sort of slipper straps and go out and get a job and get well and get off the system. We're just stabilizing them so they have as much comfort in the last days of their years as possible. So a lot of the people that we've reassessed are actually worse, and one of the reasons is because of the staffing, the caseloads, especially in those offices where they are being paid an inequitable amount as compared with state offices. So anyway, so that is what this piece is about, and I know that you're all familiar with our concerns here. Let me just mention that yesterday I learned that in the RSVP program, which, of course, as you know, you cannot buy the kind of services you get from that volunteer service organization, we need to look into this, but they are being asked to return $53,000 of their funding that they've received this year, and I think their program is essentially gutted in the governor's recommended budget and in the previous budget cut, so we'll have to look into that, but I think that would be a hardship for a number of them. The next piece I will move to is House Bills 2287 and 2288. These have been our sort of perennial House favorites, and we have moved these bills in various forms, either through the House or Senate, in ways and means for the last, this will be our third session on this. Is it our third or our fourth? Good Lordy, I can't remember. The gist of this is that when the Type B transfer, that is to say, offices where the employees used to be state employees, and now that they've been transferred to the local governments or the COGS or regional government offices, the agreement was that those employees would continue to be paid, and I'm just giving you just such the layman's version of this, but they're continue to be paid at the same rate that the state would pay itself for the same work. That is to say, dollar for dollar, a pencil, supplies, staffing, et cetera. They have a lot of flexibility, and they're allowed to do things at the local level and access local services and match programs and so forth. Those are things that the state can't necessarily do, but they were mandated to enhance all of their services using local resources. So when the state goes into a community, they don't look around necessarily in this field and say, by gosh, I wonder if we can get Taco Bell to sponsor a meal site, or I wonder if we can get donation from the community to help match programs for this fund or for that fund and so on and so forth. We are mandated to do that. But as it turns out, because of an error in the systems change for tracking these employees, we've fallen behind and in pay to those offices, and that's what we call the equity gap. And I think, I could be wrong, but I think the general fund dollar amount on that is, are we at $9 million or so? $9 million in general funds, and as you know, we match everything. So technically a $9 million contribution from the state to those five offices or so could translate into $15 to $18 million. That buys a lot of services, and that's a really wise investment for this legislature to consider. A number of years ago, in the waning hours of Ways and Means, I think Representative Westland, you'll remember this, we were given $1 million towards correction of the problem, but we didn't fix the formula, so we continue to fall behind. So every time the state gets a 2% increase, they get that 2% increase on a dollar, and we get it on 85%. So now you're up here and we're here, and you get a 2% increase, and we get a 2% increase, and the gap just gets wider. So we will, I believe, we'll be hearing these two bills in this committee in the very near future. We haven't set the date, but so that's our equity issue. And one of these bills deals with correcting the formula, which everyone will agree is in error. You will actually be able to get the Department of Human Services, SPD, the Department of Administrative Services to agree that there is a fundamental error there. And the other bill is correct the formula and hand over some cash. So we realize really that this dire problem is indirect services this year. At the very least, we would appreciate seeing the formula being corrected and plans for future budget to address this particular issue. So that is the next item I had in here. I think I have a Dear Legislator letter following that, and that's something that we gave you at the beginning of the session. And one of the things that I mentioned the other night in my testimony was that this particular legislative session makes the ninth time in 1 year that I have been before you working to save programs such as Oregon Project Independence, Levels 15 to 17, RSVP, so on and so forth. But nine times for Oregon Project Independence in 1 year between special sessions and emergency boards. So we've seen a significant reduction in our budget, $30 million in general funds to seniors and people with disabilities. And mind you, we're the primary office that provides services. So we're taking a significant hit to our program. So that is just a briefing on some of the cuts this year alone. And then I've given you, as you've seen this, and the state's given this to you too as well, it's a very short list of levels 1 through 17. And I think Representative Westland asked a question earlier. I'm not sure, but you're correct. This particular blue sheet doesn't really break down the person's, overall health and well-being at the time that they are assessed. You're correct. These are people. This isn't like an engine part where you can see that this particular piece is missing and this particular piece isn't functioning well. This can, again, be one day we're feeling well and you're having a good day, and another day you're just absolutely not doing well. So you really want to try to get a broad picture of how people are feeling. So to back that up, what I've done was I've brought an OPI client profile for you as well. And good morning. And folks that are receiving Oregon Project Independence aren't quite Medicaid eligible yet. And the reason that I've included them as our examples of priority levels is that You can see with some of the needs that you see when you look at these folks that it wouldn't take very long to spend your resources down to the point where you would become Medicaid eligible. And then you would be entitled to more services because Medicaid is more generous than Oregon Project Independence. So the goal in stabilizing, I think, the state government's budget in this particular area is to keep as many people as possible on OPI, technically sort of a pre-Medicaid tool, and stabilize their health care, keep them from spending all of their resources down and then becoming Medicaid eligible. So I've brought you something that sort of describes some of their cases. And I think, and then just there's a press release in here from the state that talked about telling seniors to begin losing their services February 1. And corresponding with that, the levels 10 through 14 announcements, those went out to clients. I believe they received them this week. And we don't have final figures yet, but, of course, any time we're losing services to clients, it translates into a loss of staff as well. And if you have any questions about that, I'd be happy to address those. So, John, did you want to... I wanted to speak to one other thing that we do. Excuse me. I'm so sorry. It's a one of the things that we'd like to discuss with this committee in the very near future is the issue of workload simplification and the effect that that can have on our staffing and our ability to handle the kind of caseload that we have. So we would appreciate an opportunity to do that. Also, we want to talk to you a little bit about the fact that a number of our offices do provide services to veterans. We had a program in place. Representative Westland helped us get this pilot program in place last session where we put a little money into and a little effort into Washington and Multnomah County. The purpose of that was to divert folks who are on Medicaid from Medicaid services to veterans services. And if you want to be a veteran services officer, the knowledge that you have to have to understand and challenge the federal veterans programs is quite extensive, and a number of our case managers just simply might not recognize a veterans eligible person when they came through the door. The questions range from, you know, was your spouse a member of the such and such brigade? If so, you're eligible for. If he was a member of this and was decorated, he gets this but not this. I mean, it's very complex, and so we're not necessarily trained our case managers. We wouldn't want to train all of our case managers to be, you know, fluent in veteran services. It's just an extensive program. There is some money for county veteran services officers around the state. It's about $12,500 a year, I think, and counties sort of make decisions about how to spend that, but it doesn't really buy you the kind of staff that we could use to divert people from our current system or to watch people that are coming in to help them navigate to get their benefits back. Every time that we are successful in doing that, then the state receives payment back for monies that they have spent, that they've invested in Medicaid clients. So if I'm not mistaken, I think we saved about $160,000 in the short duration of this program last year, and I believe there was one person alone that was sort of good for $77,000. I mean, there's a significant amount of money that we can retrieve from the federal government if we move people up. Goodbye.
Positive.
Thank you. So that's the other issue that we'll try to be, you'll hear about in some ways as we work to try to suggest ways to stabilize the budget and fix resource issues. So I think those are my sort of, that's my big picture presentation, and either John may have something to say or we'll stand for questions.
What's your questions now? Or?
Well, I, you know. Good morning, John. How are you doing? You're a type B.
Good morning, Chairman Cruz.
Excuse me. Douglas County's a type B. You're just a nice guy.
Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, my name is John DeGroot. I work for Douglas County Health and Social Services Department. I'm the Division Director for Senior and Disability Services, the part of the system that we administer in Douglas is the elderly and the developmentally disabled populations there. The non-elderly physically disabled populations are managed by the Department of Human Services through its office in Roseburg. I've been a director of Area Agency on Aging for approximately 25 years and only recently assumed the responsibility for the developmentally disabled population with the recent retirement of a long-time employee in Douglas. So I do have some comments from earlier questions that I'd like to share, and then, of course, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to follow up with any information that that you would request. Mr. Chair, it appeared as though you were concerned with disconnects in these silos in these communities, and communities across Oregon are wide-ranging in their diversities and service availabilities and resources, and part of the reason the legislature adopted a statewide policy on aging back in 1981 was to recognize that there is diversity across the state of Oregon. Burns is not like Pendleton, is not like Bend, is not like Portland. So the enabling legislation does provide quite a bit of flexibility for local governments to work with the state as partners in how to best design and operate local human service systems. So the one thing I can say is that most all of us do a plan, a local government plan, for the State Department of Human Services, and that is an opportunity for local governments to look at opportunities for best coordination and integration of human services at the county level. All of the aging and disability and mental health and public health systems require community plans. So there's an opportunity for Department of Human Services to recognize where there are points of coordination that need to be addressed. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, was it Representative Anderson's question about, there you are, smaller counties? Why weren't they participating?
It was Monica.
Might have been Miss Anderson.
Oh, there we go. I was looking to this side. And what I would like to say is that a lot of the smaller rural areas have private nonprofit corporations that operate the local senior service systems, and part of the options for local governments in the policy, the state policy on aging, is enables them to elect to participate or not to participate in the management of the local senior service systems. So generally speaking, across the state of Oregon, it's the rural areas where there are no local governments directly involved in carrying out elderly disabled programs directly in partnership with the state government that these situations occur in. And that's primarily the reason why there's not a lot of participation in these areas, because the local governments have chosen to allow a private nonprofit corporation to run them.
If I could add to this just quickly, and I think James said it very well when he said the other issue was the equity issue. If I was a local government and I was considering adding to the services, if I was a type A or so, I would seriously think about the rest of the AAA system, where you can see that they're not being paid dollar for dollar what it does to, or even close. I mean, we believe that we can do it for slightly less than state government, but when you're not even close, you wouldn't want to take on that responsibility. It would be irresponsible as a government official to take on additional programs knowing full well that the resources weren't going to follow it. So that's another reason that people are reluctant to engage in taking on more services. I think that's sort of an obvious one, that we'd be asking them to do something and then they would know that they weren't. I mean, it's 85 cents on the dollar this year. Next year it's 83. The next year it's 81. And it just keeps slipping. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, which would lead me into, well, I wanted to respond to one more question and then address a an issue of concern for us. You asked, Mr. Chair, about Medicare. Our state association has discussed opportunities to further integrate medical and long-term care services in this state for several years, and one of the opportunities that we had discussed at one time was closer coordination with the federal government's rehabilitation services under home health and also hospice. There's a lot of long-term care type services that could be perhaps better administered at the state and local levels, and these are opportunities that the federal government could entertain but has chosen not to because of this separation of Medicare and Medicaid. So there has been discussions about better integration at the community level of particularly home health, hospice, and the rehab services that are funded under Medicare for the populations that we serve, which are a substantial portion of the Medicare beneficiaries in those services in our state. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've been on the where the rubber meets the road here, so to speak, over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 months, working through issues to implement state policy as we move through the reductions. It's been very very challenging, very difficult, but we are here to say that we're doing the job, and I think we're doing it well. I think you heard this morning from James Hayes and Kathy Cooper that there are a lot of systems kinds of adjustments that have had to be made within the tools that we have to administer eligibility and who's eligible and what kinds of services they get. And we're in a major systems change, and we're working together to do that. Obviously, in major times of change like this, there are glitches, and we've experienced some glitches, if you will, in making absolutely the best effort we can to accurately assess our recipients and get treat them humanely as individuals, one-on-one, empathize with their condition, do everything within our power to help provide information, assistance, the benefit of all other kinds of services that we can provide for them at that moment in their lives when they're anxious about what their future may hold. And I want to assure you that the area agencies on aging are doing this very thing, and that doesn't mean that all of the individuals who have lost their medical assistance under Oregon Medical Assistance Program are losing their long-term care services or their OPI services are fully compensated for those losses, but the effort is there to mitigate, Mr. Chair, and I want you to know that this is happening. We are not casting people to the wind here. There are some real honest effort, and I must say with a great deal of care and compassion in how this business is being done. And this is a difficult time for our employees, but we are doing the job. And if there's any concern or any questions about having getting that job done, I'll be happy to respond to that. The final comment I'd like to make is that local governments are not in financial position to assume liability for state-funded Medicaid programs. So one of the concerns across the nation, as 40, 45 states of the union are in crisis now with Medicaid obligations. And governors are negotiating with the federal government right now on this incredible liability that this partnership has created for states. And I hope that there's some relief, and our state will sort out what its best interest is here. There are major concerns about the president's offer on Medicare, on Medicaid. But local governments...
If you're referring to the block grant proposal, it basically sucks. But that's a technical term.
Mr. Chair, I need not say any more about that.
I'll write that down so we can look that up later.
You'd be so short-sighted to go for something like that. It'd be beyond belief.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my bosses, the department head and the Board of County Commissioners of Douglas County, are not here to say that we will... bail out the state general fund. We'll do everything we can within the resources that we have. And the county government is very generous in Douglas County, very supportive of elderly and disabled, the developmental disability program. So we have a good county financial commitment to be there, but we cannot financially backfill.
Part of the reason for all my Medicaid type questions is it's something we're running into on the mental health side too. These are two separated. For example, if we separate the Medicaid mental health totally separate from OHP, it makes the risk hard to manage. If you get too small, then you're piling up risk that nobody can take on, and that's part of the conundrum we're in here, which is why I'm looking at ways to aggregate things wherever possible so we can do a better job of spreading. But of course, with OHP, we may be doing. We may be doing the adverse selection there ourselves. Who knows?
So that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. No, I get asked a question.
Sure.
Why are you a B1 rather than a B2, Douglas County?
There's a long history which started back in the early 80s. We chose to be involved in the senior services because we had a long history. We had a 6-year prior history of being involved as county government and serving in administering the Older Americans Act and OPI funded programs. So that we continued because. It meant an integrated model of care and service and access to services in Douglas County for seniors. That model is carried through since 1984. The county wanted one place to for seniors to go. And before that, there was the State Human Services Department and the County Senior Services Office. And government-funded services for the elderly population, older people had to distinguish or decide which office to go to, and it made no sense in terms of customer service. And besides that, there was the human dignity issue. And before 1984, people who had to go to the human services office for Medicaid eligibility tended to be more of our low-income population, and we simply did not want to deliver services. We wanted to deliver services based on the need, not the means to pay for those services. So that was an important decision, and we simplified the system. We looked at the option of bringing the additional disability services offices into our department and integrating those services with our developmental disability programs. When the Department of Human Services was reorganizing itself and creating service delivery areas, Representative Cruz, we offered a letter of interest to Department of Human Services, and we're in the process of discussing the accepting of those programs at the county level. The conversation basically died when one side of the Department of Human Services and the other side of the Department of Human Services weren't, frankly, working together, in my opinion, with the county government. And frankly, talks broke down, and there were situations where we couldn't agree on assuming that responsibility when, if they had it, they had more staff than if we had it. And then, of course, we aren't a transfer agency by board policy. We haven't transferred employees to local government because that's been a policy of our board, and we feel we can accomplish the intent of the legislation through the integration and coordination by managing all of the employees at the county level, both state and county. But very definitely, inequitable resources was part of the decision, Representative Cruz. If the state government, if it runs it, can have more staff and more management, and if than if a local government operates it, then I have to ask myself I'm to protect the interests of my employer, number one, and number two, we can accomplish. We're looking at the best interests of the citizens and access to services, and we figured that the access to the services for the physically disabled population would be the responsibility of the Human Services Department.
I mean, I'm trying to make some sense out of the counties that are placed where they are, because on type B2, we've got the first, second, fourth, and sixth largest counties in the state. B1, we've got the third and fifth largest counties, and the seventh is an A. And seems like it would be an economy of scale sort of thing, and it doesn't seem to be a real good transfer there. I mean, why is, Washington County is still a B1 when the other big boys are. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that Washington County is.
Okay, are there transitions going on here?
Actually, I could respond to that if you don't.
Okay, I mean, I'm assuming, and John, and what you were talking about, there was some breakdowns that happened when basically the reorg was put it at a standstill kind of in place because of budget reasons, and I guess I'm just trying to get a sense of, in this reorg, is there restructuring at this level going on here?
Representative Cruz, I'd like to respond to Washington County in particular. Washington County has asked the Department of Human Services if they could become a Type B2 contract, and we have been in the process of that approval, and we have notified them that as of March 1st this week, they will become a Type B2. They will be taking over responsibility for our disability services office in Beaverton, and then they will also have offices in Tigard and Hill Hillsboro. So they have changed to a type B2.
And is anything going on with Marion? Of course, Marion's a transfer, not a contract, so that
correct.
It's a different ballgame there then, right?
Right. Okay. It's under a council of government type in local...
Again, local mm-hmm. government choice.
Right. Choice.
And again,
mm-hmm.
the
right.
issue is... They make that decision about, I mean, Washington County and wanted to do it, and then, again, the concern is, will the money follow the shift? And if you think about it, in fact, if we move these programs back to the state, those ones where they're an equity issue, the state would have to pony up that $9 million instantly in order to operate these offices or mm-hmm. close to it. So that's the reason that you don't want it back, but... that's the reason that we're looking, and that's one of the major stumbling blocks in all of us moving to another system is people realize that the contract with the state is only as good as the special session you're in, I think. So.
And we're in six.
So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of the concern on the parts of local governments would be borne out right now as major reductions in human services are taking place, and that potential liability would be at the Board of County Commissioner level or other elected official level at local government, being the primary target or recipient of communication about reduced levels of services in those counties. So I'm sure that the county, I know that the county governments are on the receiving end of this as well, because I help them respond to letters. But there is a concern that the perception it would be that the county governments are cutting these services to these people. So that's just another piece.
And Mr. Chair, sadly, it looks confusing to you on this level, but again, if we were to travel to another state and attempt to conduct business as a senior needing services, we would be flabbergasted by the different phone numbers, and I mean, you actually have to. I'm operating in Florida right now for my family, and I have a folder full of numbers that I have to call for my parents. One who's over 65, one who is under 65, and both of them are disabled. So the services for them are not integrated, even though ours looks like it's not integrated at some level. If you're really only going to two offices or one ultimately, but two for services, we're really not doing too bad. So if you can just sort of keep that in mind as you're thinking about how convoluted this is. So and believe it or not, again, this is the model for the rest of the nation. So at some level, when they were creating this, it made sense to do it this way, and I think it still does today when you think about the income that the state generates by doing this. Again, the things like local fundraisers, local businesses contributing, local match being done, local restaurants providing foods one day a month for the meal sites. All of those kind of things are it's a bonus to the state. And again, why we sort of tolerate and enjoy at the same time this sort of piecemeal system.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good information. I want to thank everybody for bringing it in and the information they're going to get to us. And with that, we are adjourned, and I want the committee to notice it's 2 minutes early.
Good work. So.